Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! The 20th of December is what it is. This is the horn. The 20th of December, 2012. The night before the reason for the season. The night before the solstice. Right? Or is that a couple of days later? My calendrics are as bad as my on-the-fly math, so we won't really worry about it. This is the horn, the Head On Radio Network, headonradionetwork.com. A little listener-supported endeavor in something we call conversation radio. Most easily found, of course, at headonradionetwork.com. As well as a variety of portable platforms for your streaming devices and your smart devices and smartphones and so forth. Platforms like TuneIn Radio, Stitcher Radio, Tuner Internet Radio, Star.fm, Streama.com, and Roku devices. Okie doke. Okie doke. Oh, by the way, the podcast address, for those of you who wish to listen later, is over at WhiteRoseSociety.org under the subdomain for this program. And you can also pick up the podcast at iTunes. Hi. I'm Bob Kincaid. Just checking to make sure that we are getting out there. Had a note from Marty saying MP3 streaming wasn't working. Heavenly days. Hope it's not a sign of the apocalypse. Anybody? Chat room? Just waiting. Okay, we've got stuff working. It may be. I got a feeling we were due. Okay, what the hell? Okay, so Jugapunch got it on his iPad. He's trying iTunes now. Son of a gun. Okay, I flipped the first switch. Flipped the second switch. Flipped the third switch. Yeah, everything's doing what everything is supposed to be doing. Okay. Stand by for a minute. Lord, it sure do. Make things a little more interesting than you'd like for them to be. All right, that part's taken care of. Yeah, Michael noting loud and clear on both my iTunes app and my TuneIn app on my iPhone, or on my phone. UTunes, not iTunes. UTunes, my bad. All right, Big Ten 4 coming through from Kevin. Good, good, good. Okay, so maybe it's, yeah. Thank you, Tamara. Thank you very kindly. Anyway. That may be a website thing. So, hard to say. See, everything is the White Rose stream. If you're listening through, this is a little technical moment, if you're listening through TuneIn, if you're listening through Stitcher, if you're listening, there is no way to listen to this stream that is not the White Rose Society stream. So you might try the original stream over at whiterosesociety.org, but, oh, let me see if I can help here. Anyway, so here we are at the 20th of December. Okay, let me do this again. Stand by. This is a heck of a way to begin a show, right? Eh, someday we'll have a complete staff and engineers and MIS people. And my, oh my, won't it be just amazing to... Yeah. All right, let's try this again. Sometimes this feels like a little bit of a message from the universe. When I really think I know how things are going to go and what it's going to be like, and, well, that's when this kind of crap happens. But anyway, it is the 20th of December. Today I was subjected to a myriad of packages. That's what they call them there in the biz. A myriad of packages from, is it a myriad or would it be myriad without the article in front of it? Anyway, myriad packages over to the Chicken Noodle News. About everybody waiting it down to Chichen Itza for the Mayan end of the Mayan world. And I guess somewhere, some old Mayan personality is getting a good giggle out of this. And some perhaps descendant of them is making a nice bit of coin. So that's fair. But I thought, and everybody's being cute with the weather report. I got a big giggle out of one that Lottie sent me. Shows the weather for tomorrow about 1,157 degrees and, you know, flaming balls of fire. Okay, let me do this. Stand by. I can only multitask so many different ways. We'll get to start. We'll get things good. Audience falling away by the in droves. Are we still there? Yeah, we're still there. Okay. And iTunes player chooses this moment to want to be updated. Screw thou. Gonna try this again in a minute. All right, one more time. Well, this certainly does seem apocalyptic now, doesn't it? If I was a real genius, I would have had it scripted out this way. Maybe with some crackly static noise in the background. Are we reaching? Yeah. This is the horn. It's Thursday, the 20th. And I wanted to make sure, and, well, it's the 20th here. It's already the 21st in Australia, for those who are keeping score. That means that the apocalypse apparently was not planned for Australia. And because, you know, there are no reports of, right, fireballs over, yeah, over on the other side of the international dateline. At any rate, I got a note from our good buddy Robert in Australia. He said, it's the 20th of the month, time for my regular $50 Down Under challenge. I'll match $50 in donations tonight with $50 of my own. That's it. As always, don't contribute if you're going to put yourself in financial difficulty. So that will take care of the biggest big part of tonight's fundraising. Robert is ready with 50. If we can find five folks at $10 a piece, or 10 folks at $5 a piece, or two at 25, one at 50, any way you care to do it. And that way, assuming that the world doesn't end tomorrow, we'll be all right. Okay, good. Now, oh, for pity's sakes, let me try this thing. Hold on. How many other... I was going to say, I think, is no other hosts do this because, well, no other hosts don't have some sort of staff. Hey, We will get this all set up. I don't know, Marty. Marty throwing a wrinkle into the whole debate. He says, I thought it was the entire universe that was supposed to end, not just the world. Well, it may be. It may be. But if it does... Under the subject line, War of the Worlds, our buddy Michael, who will shortly have a tin of delicious roasted almonds on its way to him, our buddy Michael writes, the first 10 minutes was the worst Orson Welles impression I have ever heard, Bob. No one was buying it. Oh, see, you would think, yeah, this is what you would do if you really wanted to, somewhere in Hackensack, no, never mind. Or was it Downers Grove? I really don't remember. But anyway, I wanted to share something with you by way of, I don't know, putting a little bit of cultural flesh on the Mayan apocalypse bones. To understand the Mayan calendar is to understand a series of gears operating against other gears. So that if you had three gears and they all turned, they were different sizes, and they all turned in relationship to each other, and you took a magic marker and you made a mark on each gear, at some point in time the lines would all come together. And that's essentially what we're talking about with the ends of calendar rounds. The Mayan calendar, which was also used by other cultures as well, ran in a 52-year cycle that was referred to as a sheaf of years. And then there were 520-year cycles and 5,200-year cycles. It is the end of one of those 5,200-year cycles that has everybody's... grass skirts in a bunch. My, that was culturally insensitive of you, Bob. Yes, it was, and I apologize. The things we'll say when we're trying to be cute. But this is the end of a 5,200-year cycle. You'll notice if you do the math that it's based on... You could say that one part of Mayan, we're not really talking about Mayan, we're talking about Mesoamerican calendrics. But you'll notice that it's basically a mathematical base 13 system, if I understand things correctly. So, if the world does end tomorrow, I want you to understand why. It's because all of these goobers wandering around down at Chichen Itza are not observing the proper obsequies, nor are we. I've told you before that one of my favorite pieces of historical fiction is a book by Gary Jennings called Aztec. Now, it is not a factual account, but Mr. Jennings, in preparation to write the book, having fallen in love with the ancient history of the region, lived for 10 years in Mexico and traveled among and lived among and conversed among Nahuatl-speaking Mexican people. The word Mexico is a mistranslation of the name that the people we call Aztecs called themselves. They called themselves the Mexica, with an X making the SH diphthong, Mexica. Aztec was something related to their origin myth and a place called Aztlan, from which they had emigrated over a period of time. The Mexica dominance of the Valley of Mexico lasted only about 200 years. But in the course of those 200 years, they established a very, very rigid society. It was very, very successful. And which had extremely codified laws and customs, and built on the traditional or in the traditions of peoples who had inhabited the region before them. And one of the things that they did is when they got there, who was it, Ixtaccuhuatl, one of their early revered speakers. They had no king. The head of their society was called a revered speaker, Huitlatoani. Ordered that their history be destroyed and rewritten. They completely reinvented themselves. And in place of their real history of being given some of the worst real estate in the Valley of Mexico, they created this myth whereby they wandered until they saw a snake sitting on a cactus holding a couple of ribbons, which has since been translated into a snake sitting on a cactus holding a snake in its mouth, which appears on the Mexican flag. The Mexican government is actually contemplating at present changing its real official name. Did you know that? I didn't until I read this recently. The actual official name of Mexico is the United States of Mexico. No kidding. But it only appears on official documents and such like. But they're thinking of just changing the name of the country to Mexico because we wouldn't want... Well, if I was them, I wouldn't want to be mistaken for the United States. Would you? When's the last time the Mexicans flew a drone aircraft over a wedding in Afghanistan and bombed the snot out of it? The life out of it. Yeah, you get my point. I've been fascinated with that culture since I was about 4 or 5 years old, and I can remember the precise moment when that fascination began. It was a deadly dull Sunday afternoon. Not a lot of anything on TV, but suddenly on an ABC station. I'm almost certain it was ABC. There was a documentary about the disappeared my ass. It was butchered to death. But about the gone Mexica people. Hang on a minute. I mean, I appreciate the... Let me get another message out there. I don't know what the problem is with the stream. Sorry, I'll be back in a minute. Oh, by the way, thank you very much. We are halfway to meeting Robert's challenge this evening. That means only $25 more. Thanks very much, Ed. It helps immensely. This from Tamara, as we've gone about the start of this program by fits and starts. The program's trying to start, and I'm having a fit. Tamara, out in San Diego, says, I love how you wait until everyone can listen. That's what family's all about. By the way, Tamara says, the Jehovah's Witnesses came by today, and they assure me that some of us will be left. Probably precisely 144,000. I always wondered how they kept that dodge going once they got to Jehovah's Witness number 144,001. Anyway, to go back, so wee little Bob, tiny little guy, sees these Mexican pyramids, and I remember there was some footage of the last remnants of the flower markets of Xochimilco, and there were pictures of obsidian blades, and I was captivated at that moment. It only got worse later on in college when I had classes on so-called pre-Columbian or American prehistory. But along the way somewhere, I read this book by Jennings, and it's very fanciful, and there's a lot of sexy time in it and stuff, so it's not something you want to hand over to the six-year-old. At 1,000 pages, the six-year-old probably wouldn't be interested anyway. But just about every primary source of what is left of the history of that magnificent gone situation. In the course of doing my research today, I ran across a website from some bunch of libertarian freakazoids. Well, I'm just glad they're gone. You know they did human sacrifice? If that don't violate personal freedom, I don't know what does. Oh, God. Yeah, right. Shall we delve deeply into the Stone Age, history of you, your white European ancestors there, buddy? Yeah, you ever seen one of those guys beat over the head and thrown into a bog? Yeah, peace-loving libertarians. Anyway, Jennings does a very good job. There's not much about Mexica culture that he doesn't somewhere incorporate into his book, and I've even read an article by a guy who was doing his graduate and postgraduate work on that culture, who talks about how accurate it turns out he was. So I thought I would share with you a passage from Aztec, so you can understand that if everything does fall apart tomorrow, or in about, I don't know, 5.5 hours. Well, we'll know why. We have failed to properly appease the gods. The gods being Huitzilopochtli, Tlaloc, Coatlicue, that bunch. Jennings, speaking in the voice of his protagonist, Mishtli, writes, and this is a lengthy passage, so bear with it. It's worth it. It's really good. If you've never read the book, you really should, if you can stand sexy time scenes. Because even the, and I'm telling you, the sexy time scenes even get a little weird. Okay, they get a lot weird. But it's I've never read a piece of historical fiction to rival this. And he wrote several other books that are quite good, but nothing touches this. If one would be fair, there was a book written by, I believe, a Norwegian author, perhaps a Finnish author, in the 1940s called The Egyptian. And I think, although there's no direct proof, I just think from the way it's structured that Jennings got his idea for Aztec probably having read The Egyptian, because The Egyptian was hugely popular way back then. And since a lot of people talked about how nasty it was, everybody and their cousin read it. It's kind of like that movie Zero Dark Thirty, which could have been left to sort of wither away in obscurity had the political types not decided to have a hit, and the for-profit media types decided not to have a hissy over it. Nothing like banned in Boston to help the sale of a book. Or a movie. Anyway, the new fire ceremony. One day toward the close of the year one rabbit, a palace page came hurrying to summon me to an immediate appearance before the Uitlatoani. I mention the year because it had an ominous significance of its own, as I shall explain later. Moricutsoma did not bid me omit the ritual of repeatedly kissing the earth as I entered and crossed the throne room, but he impatiently drummed his fingers upon his knee, as if wishing I would hasten the approach. The revered speaker was unattended on that occasion, but I noticed two new additions to the room. On each side of his Iqbali throne, a great metal wheel hung by chains in a carved wooden frame. One was of gold, the other of silver. Each disc was three times the diameter of a war shield. Both were intricately embossed and etched with scenes of Motokutsoma's triumphs and with word pictures explaining them. The two wheels were of incalculable worth, just for their weight of precious metal, but they were made vastly more valuable by the artistry lavished upon them. It was not until a later time that I learned they were more than ornaments. Motokutsoma could reach out and pound a fist upon either one of them, which sent a hollow boom resounding throughout the palace. Since each made a slightly different booming note, his hammering on the silver disc would bring the chief steward hurrying to him, and a blow upon the gold would bring a whole troop of armed guards on the run. Without any formal greeting, without any withering sarcasm, with considerably less than his customary icy calm, Motokutsoma said, "Knight Mishli, you are familiar with the Maya lands and people." I said, "Yes, Lord Speaker." "Would you consider these people unusually excitable or unstable?" "Not at all, my lord. To the contrary, most of them are nowadays about as phlegmatic as so many tapirs or manatees." He said, "So are many priests, but that does not hinder their seeing portentous visions. What of the Maya in that respect?" "Seeing visions? Well, my lord, I dare say the gods might vouchsafe a vision to even the most torpid of mortals, especially if he has intoxicated himself with something like the godflesh mushrooms. But the pathetic remnants of the Maya scarcely take note of the real world around them, let alone anything extraordinary. Perhaps if my lord would further enlighten me as to exactly what we're discussing." He said, "A Maya swift messenger came from what nation or tribe, I do not know. He came rushing through the city, not at all torpidly, and paused only long enough to gasp a message to the guard at my palace gate. Then he ran on in the direction of Tlacopan before I could be told the message, or I would have ordered him held for questioning. It appears that the Maya are sending such men pelting through all the lands to tell of a marvel which has been seen in the south. There is a peninsula there called the Ulu'unilkuts, which juts into the northern ocean. You know it? Very well. The Maya inhabitants of that coast have recently been amazed and affrighted by the appearance offshore of two objects never seen by them before." He could not resist keeping me in suspense for a moment's pause. "Something like a giant house floating upon the sea, something gliding along with the aid of widespread wings." I smiled in spite of myself, and he scowled, saying, "Are you now about to tell me that the Maya do have demented visions?" "No, my lord," I said, still smiling, "but I believe I know what it was they saw. May I ask a question?" He gave me a curt nod. "Those things mentioned, floating house, winged object, were they the same things or separate?" Motokutsoma scowled more darkly. The messenger was gone before any more details could be elicited. He did say that two things had been sighted. I suppose one could have been a floating house and the other an object with wings. Whatever they were, they reportedly stayed well offshore, so it is likely that no observer could give any very accurate description. Why do you maintain that cursed grin?" I tried to repress it, and said, "Those people did not imagine those things, Lord Speaker. They are merely too lazy to have investigated them. If any observer had had the initiative and courage to swim close, he would have recognized them as sea creatures, wonderful ones, and perhaps not a common sight, but no profound mystery, and the Maya messengers would not now be spreading unwarranted alarm." "Do you mean you have seen such things?" said Motokutsoma, regarding me almost with awe. "A floating house?" "Not a house, my lord, but a fish literally and honestly bigger than any house, the ocean fishermen call the Yayimichi." I told of how I had once been helplessly adrift in a canoe upon the sea, when whole hosts of the monsters had floated close enough to endanger my frail craft. The revered speaker may find it hard to credit it, but if a Yayimichi had its head butting the wall outside my lord's window yonder, its tail would be flapping among the remains of the late speaker Ahuitzotl's palace, clear on the other side of the great plaza. "Say you so," Motokutsoma murmured, wonderingly looking out the window. Then he turned again to me to ask, "And during your sojourn at sea, did you also encounter water creatures with wings?" "I did, my lord. They flew in swarms about me, and at first I took them to be ocean insects of immense size, but one of them actually glided into my canoe, and I seized it and ate it. Indisputably, it was a fish. but just as indisputably it had wings with which it flew. Motokutsoma's rigid posture relaxed a little, clearly in relief. "Only fish," he muttered. "May the doltish Maya be damned to Mictlan. They could panic the entire populations with their wild tales. I will see that the truth is instantly and widely told. Thank you, Knight Mishtli. Your explanation has served a most useful purpose. You deserve a reward. Let it be this. I invite you and your family to be among the select few who, with me, will ascend Wishachi Hill for the new fire ceremony next month." "I shall be honored, my lord," I said. And I meant it. The new fire ceremony came but once every 52 years, and few were those who could say they had seen two, and fewer still those who had seen it in the presence of the revered speaker. In preparation for the new fire ceremony, families got rid of all their kitchen implements and extinguished their fires, disposed of utensils made of copper or even precious metals. They burned their wooden spoons and platters and chocolate beaters and other such implements. During those 5 days, those 5 dead days of the calendar, they did no cooking anyway, and ate only scantily, and used segments of maguey leaves for dishes, and used their fingers to scoop and eat cold-baked kamotin or congealed atole mush or whatever else they had prepared in advance. There was no traveling, no trading or other business conducted, no social mingling, no wearing of jewelry or plumes or any but the plainest garments. No one, from the Uitlatoani to the lowliest Lakotli slave, did anything but wait and remain as inconspicuous as possible while he waited. Though nothing noteworthy had happened during those somber days, our tension and apprehension understandably increased, reaching its height when Tonatiuh went to his bed on the 5th evening. We could only wonder, would he rise once more and bring another day, another year, another sheaf of years? I should say that the common folk could only wonder. It was the task of the priests to try what persuasion was in their power. Shortly after that sundown, when the night was full dark, a whole procession of them, the chief priest of every god and goddess, major and minor, each priest costumed and masked and painted to the semblance of his particular deity, marched from Tenochtitlan and along the southern causeway toward Wishachi Hill. They were trailed by the revered speaker and his invited companions, all dressed in such humbly shapeless garments of sacking that they were unrecognizable as lords of high degree, wise men, sorcerers, whatever. Among them was myself, leading my daughter Nochipa by the hand. "You are only 9 years old now," I had told her, "and there's a very good chance that you will still be here to see the next new fire. But you might not be invited to see that ceremony up close. You are fortunate to be able to observe this one." She was thrilled by the prospect, for it was the first major religious celebration to which I had yet escorted her. Had it not been such a solemn occasion, she would have skipped merrily along at my side. Instead, she paced slowly, as was proper, wearing drab raiment and a mask fashioned by me from a piece of maguey leaf. As we followed the rest of the procession through a darkness relieved only by the dim light of a sliver of moon, I was reminded of the time so long ago when I had been thrilled to accompany my own father across Xaltocan to see the ceremony honoring the fowler god Atlawa. Nochipa wore a mask concealing her whole face because on that most precarious night of all nights, every child did. The belief, or the hope, was that the gods, if they did decide to expunge mankind from the earth, might mistake the disguised young folk for creatures other than human, and might spare them, and so there would be at least some seedling survivors to perpetuate our race. The adults did not try any such feeble dissimulation, but neither did they go to sleep resigned to the inevitable. Everywhere in the lightless land, our people spent that night upon their rooftops, nudging and pinching each other to keep awake, their gaze fixed in the direction of Wishachi Hill, praying for the blaze of the new fire to tell them that the gods had once again deferred the ultimate disaster. The hill called in our language Wishachatlan is situated on the promontory between Lakes Texcoco and Xochimilco. just south of the town of Ixtapalapan. Its name came from its thickets of huichache scrub, which at that season of the turning of the year were just beginning to open their tiny yellow flowers of disproportionately great and sweet fragrance. The hill had little other distinction, since it was a mere pimple in comparison to the mountains farther distant, but jutting up abruptly from the flat terrain around the lakes, it was the one eminence sufficiently high and near enough to all the lake communities to be visible to the inhabitants of them all, as far away as Texcoco to the east and Xaltocan to the north, and that was the reason for its having been selected sometime far back in our history as the site of the new fire ceremony. As we mounted the path that spirals gently toward the hilltop, I was close enough to Maricutsoma to hear him murmur worriedly to one of his counselors, "The Chiquasentetl will rise tonight, will they not?" The wise man, an elderly but still keen-eyed astronomer, shrugged and said, "They always have, my lord. Nothing in my studies indicates that they will not always do so." Chiquasentetl means a group of six. Moricutsoma was referring to the tight little cluster of six faint stars whose ascent in the sky we had come to see, or hoping to see. The astronomer, whose function was to calculate and predict such things as star movements, sounded sufficiently confident to dispel anybody's qualms. On the other hand, the old man was notoriously irreligious and outspoken in his opinions. He had infuriated many a priest by saying flatly, as he did just then, "No god of all the gods we know has ever shown any power to disrupt the orderly progress of the heavenly bodies." "If the gods put them there, old unbeliever," snapped a seer, "the gods can shift them at will. They simply have not, in our lifetime of watching the skies, been so inclined. Anyway, the question is not so much whether the Chiquasentetl will rise, but will the group of six be at the exact proper point of ascent in the sky, at the exact middle point of the night?" "Which is not so much up to the gods," the astronomer said dryly, "as to the time sense of the priest blowing the midnight trumpet, and I will wager he is drunk long before then. But by the way, friend sorcerer, if you are still basing any of your prophecies on the so-called group of six stars, I am not surprised that you are so often wrong. We astronomers have long known them to be Chiquasentetl, a group of seven."
"You dare to refute the books of divination?" sputtered the seer. "They all say and always have said Chiquasentetl."
"So do most people speak of a group of six. It takes a clear sky and clear eyes to see it, but there is indeed a seventh pale star in that cluster."
"Will you never cease your irreverent aspersions?" snarled the other. "You're simply trying to confound me, to cast doubt on my predictions, to defame my venerable profession."
"Only with facts, venerable sorcerer," said the astronomer. "Only with facts." Maricutsoma chuckled at the exchange, sounding no longer worried about the outcome of the night, and then the three men moved out of my hearing as we reached the summit of Huichache Hill. A number of junior priests had preceded us there, and they had everything in readiness. There was a neat stack of unlighted pine splint torches and a towering pyramid of kindling and logs which would be the signal fire. There were other combustibles, a fire drilling stick and its block and scorched thread tinder, finely shredded bark, wads of oil-soaked cotton, the knight's chosen Xochimilque, a clean-limbed young warrior recently captured from Tezcala, already lay arched naked across the sacrificial stone. Since it was essential that he lie still throughout the ceremony, he had been given a drink containing some priestly drug, so he lay quite relaxed, his eyes closed, his limbs loose, even his breathing barely perceptible. The only light was from the stars and a bit of moon overhead, and the reflected moonlight made the lake shine below us. But our eyes had by then become adjusted to the darkness, and we could make out the folds and contours of the land around the hill, the cities and towns looking dead and deserted, but really waiting, wide awake and almost audibly pulsing with apprehension. There was a cloud bank on the horizon to the east, so it was some while before the awaited and prayed-for stars climbed above it into visibility, but finally they came, the pale cluster, and after them the bright red star that always follows. We waited while they made their slow way up the sky, and we waited breathlessly, but they did not vanish on the way, or fly asunder, or veer from their accustomed course. At last a collective sigh of relief went up from the crowded hill when the time-counting priest blew a bleat on his conch shell to mark the night's mid-moment. Several people breathed. "They are in the right place, right on time. And the chief priest of all the priests present, the high priest of Huitzilopochtli, commanded in a mighty roar, "Let the new fire be lighted!" A priest placed the fire block on the chest of the prostrate Xochimilque and carefully fluffed the threads of tinder upon it. A second priest, on the other side of the stone, leaned over with the drilling stick and began to twirl it between his palms. All of us spectators waited anxiously. The gods could still deny us the spark of life. But then a wisp of smoke rose from the tinder. In another moment there was a glow of tentative smoldering. The priest, holding the block steady with his one hand, used his other to feed and coax the firefly spark. Tufts of oily cotton, shreds of dry bark, and achieved a small, flickering but definite flame. It seemed to wake the Xochimilque slightly. His eyes opened enough to look down at the awakening new fire on his breast, but he did not look for long. One of the attending priests gingerly moved the fire-bearing block aside. The other produced a knife and made his slash so deftly that the young man scarcely twitched. When the chest was laid open, the one priest reached in, plucked loose the throbbing heart, and lifted it out, while the other set the blazing block in its place in the gaping wound, then quickly but expertly laid upon it still more and bigger bits of cotton and bark. When there was a sizable flag of flame rising from the chest of the feebly stirring victim, the other priest laid the heart gently in the middle of the fire. The flame subsided momentarily, dampened by the heart's blood, but they rose again with vigor, and the frying heart sizzled loudly. A cry went up from all present, "The new fire is lighted!" And the crowd, immobile until then, commenced a bustle of movement. One after another, in order of rank, the priests seized the torches from the stack and touched them to the Xochimilque's fast crisping breast to light them in the new fire, then bore them away at a run. The first one used his torch to ignite the waiting pyramid of wood, so that every distant eye fixed on Huishachi Hill should see the great blaze and know that all danger was past, that all was still well with the one world. I fancied I could hear the cheers and laughs and happy sobs that went up from the rooftop watchers all around the lakes. Then the priests ran down the hill's pathway, their torch fires fluttering behind them like hair aflame. At the base of the hill waited still other priests, gathered from communities near and far. They seized the torches and scattered to bear the precious fragments of the new fire to the temples of the various cities and towns and villages. "Take off your mask, Nochipa," I told my daughter. "It is safe now to do so. Take it off so you may see better." She and I stood on the north side of the hilltop watching the tiny flares and sparks of light explode away from beneath us, streaking off in all directions. Then there were other silent explosions. The nearest town, Ixtapalapan, was the first to have its main temple fire relighted. Then the next nearest town, of Mexicatzaltzinco. And at each temple were waiting numbers of the town's inhabitants to plunge their own torches into the temple fires and run to relight the long cold hearth fires of their families and neighbors. So each torch that streaked away from Huishachi Hill first dwindled to a mere bright dot in the distance, then blossomed into a temple fire, then that exploded into an outflung burst of sparks, and each darting spark left a trail of motionless sparks behind it. The sequence was repeated over and over, in Coyoacan, in Great Tenochtitlan, in communities further away and farther apart, until the whole vast bowl of the lakelands was fast coming again to light and life. It was a cheering, thrilling, exhilarating sight to see, and I tried hard to imprint it among my happier memories, because I could not hope to see such a sight ever again. As if reading my thoughts, my daughter said quietly, "Oh, I do hope I live to be an old woman. I should so like to see this wonder the next time, Father." When Nochipa and I finally turned back to the big fire, four men were crouched near it in earnest consultation. The revered speaker Motokutsoma, the chief priest of Huitzilopochtli, the seer and the astronomer of whom I earlier spoke. They were discussing what words the Uitlatoani would speak the next day to proclaim what the new fire had promised for the years to come. The seer, squatting over some diagrams, had drawn in the earth with a stick, had evidently just delivered himself of a prophecy to which the astronomer took exception, for the latter was heard saying mockingly, "No more droughts, no more miseries, a fruitful sheaf of years in the offing, very consoling, friend sorcerer, but you see no imminent omens appearing in the skies?" The seer snapped at him, "The skies are your affair. You make the maps of them, and I will attend to reading what the maps have to tell." The astronomer snorted. You might find more inspiration if once in a while you looked at the stars instead of the foolish circles and angles you draw. He pointed at the scratches in the dirt. You read of no impending equiloqua, then? The word means an eclipse. The seer, the priest, the revered speaker of all three repeated together at unsteadily, "Eclipse?" "Of the sun," said the astronomer. "Even this old fraud could foresee it if he once looked at past history instead of pretending to know the future." The seer sat gulping, speechless. Atacutsuma glared at him. The astronomer went on. "It is on record, Lord Speaker, that the Maya of the South saw an equiloqua take a hungry bite of Tonatiuh, the sun, in the year 10 house. Next month, in the day 7 lizard, it will have been exactly 18 solar years and 11 days since that occurred. And according to the records collected by me and my predecessors from lands north and south, such a darkening of the sun regularly happens somewhere in the one world at intervals of that duration. I can confidently predict that Tonatiuh will again be eclipsed by a shadow on the day 7 lizard. Unfortunately, not being a sorcerer, I cannot tell you how severe will be that equiloqua, or nor which lands it will be visible. But those who see it may take it for a most maleficent omen coming so soon after the new fire. I would suggest, my lord, that all peoples ought to be informed and forewarned to make their fright the less." "You are right," said Madakutsama. "I will send swift messengers into all lands, even those of our enemies, lest they interpret the omen to mean that our power is weakening. Thank you, Lord Astronomer. As for you," he turned coldly to the trembling seer, "the most wise and expert of diviners is liable to error, and that is forgivable, but a totally inept one is a real hazard to the nation, and that is intolerable. On return to the city, report to my palace guard for your execution." So there you have it. If it all comes undone, if it all falls down, and by the way, it's supposed to be by earthquake, in case anyone's paying attention, it will be because we have failed to do proper honor to the gods. Not that I'm suggesting that we take any naked anesthetized man and build a fire in the hollow where his heart used to be. Seems a bit much. But can you imagine? That's just a fun book, and it's a fun passage, and there's nothing... The whole book is magnificent. And so we took a little time with the passages once we got everybody listening on the same streams. But the multi-billion dollar for-profit media have done countless hours of bullshit fake journalism on this stuff. "Well, Bill, I'm standing here in Chichen Itza. You can see there are many tourists wandering behind me." Yeah, so? Next up, what one woman is doing to prepare in case the apocalypse actually comes. Sheesh. I mean, there's stupid, and there's stupid. I mean, even, for God's sakes, even the Maya will tell you that the close of a calendar round only means that a new one starts. This is most assuredly not rocket science. But that's what we get. Indeed, that is what we get. But I did have Chicken Noodle News on for a little bit earlier today. And along the way, I heard something else. Mercifully, that had nothing to do with Mayan apocalyptic visions that were merely... extremely well-informed exercises in mathematics and astronomy. In addition to that, I heard a package
from the chief Pentagon correspondent of Chicken Noodle News, a woman by the name of Barbara Starr. It was a report on sexual abuse in the service academies. Okay. And buried in the body of her report, a phrase, a sentence, if you will, talking about what was coming, or not what was coming, but talking about what was the kinds of sexual abuse that had been documented via the investigation. And she said something like, allegations, there were 200 and some odd allegations, including everything from unwanted, unwelcome touching to forcible rape. And I kicked a piece of furniture. And I yelled, ouch. Forcible rape. Now, this woman has been CNN's Pentagon correspondent, I think, from about the time that the actual cornerstone, whichever corner it happens to be on, of the Pentagon was laid. But there it was, right-wing talking points, in the middle of a report that had really no politics to it whatsoever, but did happen to deal with women's bodies. In this case, women's bodies who happened to have volunteered them to attend the service academies, where suddenly rape has an adjective in front of it, forcible rape, as if there was a subtext of non-forcible rape or sort of rape or kind of rape or I don't know, good rape or easy rape or any of those other things that right-wing repiglickens were using before the election to describe the many and various forms of violations of a woman's body. And there was one other story. One other story. And that story was not so much a story as a tease. And the tease was by a woman who is alleged to be a reputable journalist of international affairs by the name, of course, you recognize her, Christiana Manpour, who appeared at the news desk on camera to pitch some sort of special that she's got going over on ABC featuring, I think, Robert Ballard. Wasn't he the guy who discovered the Titanic? And her special is going to be about how Robert Ballard thinks he has found a submerged ancient archaeological city of some 7,000 years age. Well, now, most of us in the Horn family would say, what? A city 7,000 years old? Might that be the Atlantis myth to which Plato referred? But that wasn't where Christiana Manpour was going. See, I don't just do things. No. On the one hand, you've got, in the text from Aztec that I just shared with you, an imagining of what was a very real world before it was utterly destroyed through genocide and outright theft by the Spaniards. They almost completely wiped out Mexica culture and the cultures of every people around in that area, because they piled up massive, almost mountainous mounds of tree fiber, tree bark, and fawn skin
books and folios, if you will, and lit them afire at the order of the Roman Catholic Church because they were deemed to be satanic. Some, however, did survive. They are treasures in museums now. One of them is the Florentine Codex. Another is the Dresden Codex. Brilliant work was done by people like Bernardo de las Casas to document the ancient ways before the Spaniards murdered that brilliant civilization. But it was very much a real thing. There is even a hotel, and it's quite exclusive, right in the heart, or what the Mexica would have called the heart of the one world. Smack dab in the middle of what would have once been Tenochtitlan. And it's a hotel now. And if you're a member of the 1% and you can afford it, you can literally sleep in a Mexica palace that still stands. That world was very real. But there, on a channel that purports to be hard news all the time, journalism, by God, was Christiane Amanpour dredging up the most old, tired, and discredited aspect of archaeology and anthropology that there yet remains this side of the search for El Dorado. For in fact, she said that her report with Robert Ballard seeks to find the source of the ancient Old Testament story of the real, live, honest-to-goodness, no-kidding flood. You know, the one that Noah was in. Even though the story of Noah was ripped off and inserted in the New in the Old Testament after the flood stories having promulgated all over that region. But by God, it's Noah! Whose reality is being sought. I thought about our buddy Dr. John and figured if he had seen the same thing, he probably would have put his foot through the LCD screen of the TV. There is no more harm done to real live, honest to Jesus, scientific inquiry into humankind's ancient past than breathless for-profit media members talking about finding proof of the reality of the Bible. Oh, my aching back. So that's the first hour of this Night Before the Apocalypse. I can report to you, however, that our buddy Horst is in the chat room across the international dateline, and so far there have been no earthquakes or great meteors flying from the sky, nor zombies pecking incessantly and insistently at his door. So, yeah, you get the idea. Very funny, Horst. Of course the Bible's real. I've seen hundreds. All right, the contents of it. So we'll take a little break and come back. It is Thursday. That means we have the Green News Report on its way for you. Stick around if you're on hold. We will open the phone lines immediately after our return. Not that I'm going anywhere. Actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to change out the propane bottle in this freezing studio and try to get warm. But there's reality and there's fantasy. And the single best way of abusing reality is to reduce it, to parody it.
with fantasies based in money-grubbing fraud like this Mayan calendar horse shit. I mean, it works very well, the Mayan calendar. It's just not any better at predicting future events than, say, my cracked magic eight ball that always says, answer hazy, ask again later. We are halfway to meeting Robert's $50 Down Under 20th of the Month challenge, and that would take us to two-thirds of the way toward raising what we need to raise on any given evening. Your help is much appreciated. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. Under the tab Contribute, so too is the snail mail address. This is Conversation Radio on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Calling Paris. Come in, London. Come in, New York. Hello, Rio. The bad news is the world is ending. The good news is there's a party, but you better get here quick.
When you feel like they've written off factor on Deadwood, about to get fed to the pigs. When that creature's bust from hell, blasting just cowbell, parked itself in front of your dig. There's a place you can go called Tierra del Fuego. Down in the southern hemisphere, it's kind of Troy without Helen, past the Straits of Magellan. And things are always looking up down here. 'Cause there's a party at the end of the world, where the locals do the tango twirl. Forget the temples in Nepal, cancel the Fed in Montreal. There's a party at the end of the world. Well, it seems like I've run out of reasons to be here, so I'm just gonna steal from myself. If your attitude's appalling, there's a latitude that's calling. Get yourself past that continental shelf. Now the band that we hired is playing quite inspired, singing Eskimos and eunuchs from Bangkok. And the location's so nice, we'll never run out of ice, 'cause Antarctica is just around the block. There's a party at the end of the world, where the locals do that tango twirl. Now don't make that big mistake and wind up with Miss Jamaica. There's a party at the end of the world. Flying machines, yellow submarines, French girls and cowboy decor. RSVP is the needed, you see, and they'll all just be screaming for more. I'm more, I'm more. Haven't heard, things are getting quite absurd. Nothing really shocks us, that's for sure. Roadside bombers and tsunamis, oh God, how I miss those commies. No one seems to play fair anymore. But I've spoken to the yogis, had some meetings with my roadies, who assure me the arrangements are complete. Just below the roaring 40s, I am gonna fly some sorties. You'd best arrange that cherished window seat. The party at the end of the world, where the locals do the tango twirl. I don't care about the rapture when there's native girls to capture. There's a party at the end of the world. Who cares if there's no fire? We'll be rocking in her schwire. At the party at the end, you surely must attend. The party at the end of the world.
It's Thursday, December 20, 2012.
Ready, set, snow.
Snow is back. Blizzard brings winter back to the Midwest.
I am a firm believer that climate change is real, that it is impacted by human behavior.
Times Person of the Year promises action on climate change.
It's Thursday, December 20, 2000. It's Thursday, December 20, 2012.
Ready, set, snow.
Snow is back. Blizzard brings winter back to the Midwest.
I am a firm believer that climate change is real, that it is impacted by human behavior.
Times Person of the Year promises action on climate change. Can he finally deliver in the new year? The good news and the bad, the top environmental stories of the year. Plus,
some people would have us believe that on the 21st of December 2012, the ancient Mayans had predicted that a cataclysmic event would occur, destroying the whole world.
It's the end of the Mayan apocalypse myth as we know it.
Says you. All of that and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for what may be your last 6 minutes ever of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The new stupid America, that should have been Man of the Year.
No, Rush, you weren't even in the running. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, you call the Mayan prediction of the coming end of the world a myth, but could these people have survived for so many millennia to this day if they didn't know what the hell they were talking about?
Except they didn't.
Oh, yeah. Press on.
Well, first, we've got a quick rundown of some of the year's top environmental stories. It was a record bad year by any measure. Record heat waves, record drought, record wildfires, and record storms, like Superstorm Sandy here in the U.S. and around the world. Plus, the record Arctic ice melt this summer. And don't forget the record melt on the surface of the Greenland ice sheet. Plus, all the scientific warnings that we're reaching a dangerous tipping point with the climate, on top of the lack of action at the UN Climate Summit to reduce our emissions of greenhouse gases. But there was lots of good news on the list, too. To name just a few, Australia implemented a nationwide carbon tax on their biggest industrial polluters, and Australia did not collapse into a Mad Max hellscape.
Yet.
Millions of acres of new undersea marine reserves were set aside as sanctuaries worldwide. 2012 had fewer billion-dollar weather disasters than record-breaking 2011.
See, global warming is over. Proof. You can't deny it, Des.
Renewable energy continued to be the fastest-growing job sector in the U.S., while Germany smashed the world record when it produced 50% of its electricity from solar power alone in May. And the clean energy economy continues to explode worldwide. We've got lots more good news at our website, greennews.bradblog.com.
And with the Germans producing 50% of their energy from solar in a year where clearly global warming has ended, it's obvious that Germany has made a cleaner, better world for nothing.
That's one way of looking at it. Some more potential good news for the climate.
I am a firm believer that climate change is real, that it is impacted by human behavior and carbon emissions. And as a consequence, I think we've got an obligation to future generations to do something about it.
That was President Obama in his first post-election press conference after winning re-election in November. Obama has been declared Time Magazine's Person of the Year for 2012 for his historic re-election. And in his interview with Time, which occurred prior to the Newtown school shootings, the president again promised to take action on climate change as one of his top three agenda items in his second term. So at least he's talking about it.
Yeah, he's good at talking about it.
And I got some groceries for the rest of the week, because who knows how long we're going to be snowed in.
Some relief for the drought-stricken Midwest with a big blast of winter.
A massive snowstorm barrels across the country from the Rockies to the Midwest.
After last year's record warm winter that wasn't, a blizzard and winter storms are snarling traffic and airline travel just in time for the holidays.
More proof the global warming is over.
Yeah, no, not so much. But the headaches come with a silver lining.
You get to have a lot of fun in it, like building a snowman, having a snowball fight.
But more importantly, this storm is bringing much-needed moisture to the parched Midwest. It'll take quite a bit more to climb out of the record drought, still gripping 60% of the country, but it's better than nothing, which is what we got last year. Finally, Friday marks the end of the Mayan long calendar and hopefully the end of all the hype over the fake Mayan apocalypse. Mayan scholars and scientists the world over have spent the last several years with the annoying task of patiently explaining that the end of the long calendar is actually just the beginning of the next one. NASA was so confident that the world will not end on Friday, December 21st, that they released their December 22nd debunking video 2 weeks early.
Confident or just playing it safe, since they knew no one would be able to see it after the world ended?
Ooh.
Otherwise, with all this good news in today's Green News Report, clearly it's another sign that the world is ending. Check out those stories and much more at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. We're going to be standing down from the Green News Report over the next couple of weeks, not just because the world is ending, but we hope you have safe, happy, and healthy holidays, whether the world ends or not.
We'll see you next year.
Maybe you will. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
It's your second hour in the liberal sandbox,
and you're
it's
head
your
on
second
with
hour
Bob.
In the liberal sandbox,
and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Well, another thing to add to the list of stuff that behaves funny. A little virtual cart deck we use here. Well, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is the second hour of this Thorn in the Side Thursday, the 20th of December. Lines are open, 304-658-3333, and also contact is available, and you can get on the program by contact reaching out via Skype. The account, the handle, is Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, Bob Kincaid Horn. And, of course, the email is what it has been for, lo, these many years, Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, at gmail.com. You can also find me on Facebook at the same name, spelled the same way, and the same goes for Twitter. So, there you have it. Like I said, the phone lines are open, and let us go immediately and directly to them. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. This is Carol in Las Vegas.
Hey, Carol. How are you?
Not too bad. First off, since we're talking about ancient things, I just thought I'd throw this out there, that many people don't realize that the three pyramids in Giza...
Yes.
Since I took some geology in college decades ago, I had a professor that made me aware of this. There is vertical water erosion on the pyramids in Giza, which means there had to be enough heavy rainfall for that to happen. And the best science available says that the last time there was that kind of rainfall in that area of the world was at least 10,000 years ago. So the information that we were all told in school about the pyramids being 4,500 years old and blah blah blah, just is not true.
And, yeah, I've actually read some of that stuff myself. The archaeoastronomy.
Yeah.
That talks about how the belt of Orion lines up with the three pyramids and also well, too much. But don't say any of that around, what's his name, Nawaz, the head of Egyptian antiquities in Egypt. He gets really, really testy.
Yeah, the, you know, I don't want to go on and on about that. I just thought I'd throw that
out. Well, no, I think there's things like the erosion around and the, construction of the Sphinx and yeah, the pyramids. Yeah, there's a lot left to be learned, and I'm kind of fascinated with that speculative what will we call it, speculative ancient history or speculative history, or I don't know exactly what the right term of it is. But there's stuff we don't know.
Well, a kind of a funny little book, I don't know, that I think contains a lot of facts is called Everything You Know Is Wrong by Lloyd Pye. I'll just throw that out there. But the second thing I wanted to bring up, since on your program yesterday, I wasn't aware of this until I heard it listening to your podcast, was that Mr. Bork has left this world. And I'm sorry to say that that put a big smile on my face.
You know, you're not the only one, so don't feel too bad, Carol.
The sick human being that I am. And
the sad thing is he has shuffled off this mortal coil, but just as quick as one goes, another one fills his place. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And I'll just say on that he was an A number one piece of you know what. So now if we could just, you know, get Dick Cheney to follow, the world would be a better place.
Yeah, Dick Cheney. And you know what? If there's any truth to, like, genetic knowledge and stuff, that decent human being's heart that's inside Dick Cheney's chest is screaming, begging for death.
Oh, you know, from what I understand, when people donate hearts, they don't really know who they go to, but I have to think that that the family of whose heart was donated would just have to be...
appalled?
Totally appalled.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading that business about the new fire ceremony. If I was that person's heart, I'd be saying, yeah, I'll do it. Yank it out.
Yeah.
That's fine. Can't put the kindling in. Worthy cause. Let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I tried to get into your program the other day, and it was pretty full. But I just want to make a couple comments on, this terrible situation that happened in Connecticut. And, you know, a lot of it's been said, but, the mother was definitely, from everything I've read and heard, an acolyte of people like Alex Jones. And, that was a personal choice that she made. And while I have great sympathy for parents, like I said before, I've never had children, but to have a child that has some really, really tough special needs is got to be just a nightmare. But for working people and stuff like that. But, you know, this woman was not an average woman. She was getting $12,000 a month in alimony.
Oh, by the way, that was $12,000 every 2 weeks, I found out today.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's even every 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know...
$220,000 a year.
Well, that even further makes the point that you know, why would someone who's, you know, having that type of lifestyle spend the money and her time, you know, with this ridiculous craziness on the right... you know, bringing these weapons in to her home, but mainly just making them available. Not, you know, I'm, you know, stating the obvious, but you know, it was her decision, and I think that sometimes, you know, those of us on the left tend to, and sometimes for good reasons, you know, cut women a little more slack. But I think if this would have been a single father, he would have been crucified, and deservedly so, for his actions that I believe set this up.
Well, it's kind of interesting, Carol, because some of the questions, not that anybody, I mean, I'm not taking credit for anything, it's just, you know, over the course of years, when you've learned to think a certain way, you think a certain way, and the questions I was asking about, you know, did they get into the, you know, has anybody gotten the divorce documents unsealed, you know, what have they learned from the, you know, from the ex-husband?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I saw a report about that today, and that work has been done. And there, you know, there, the divorce, the settlement document was examined, and yeah, that's where that, I mean, $200 and some odd $1,000 a year in alimony. The husband had agreed to pay for a car and college and graduate school for the son, both sons, I guess. They split up. Well, they split up when Adam was 17 years old. And it, you know, it paints a picture of a family that's very definitely part of the 1%.
Absolutely.
And you, on the one hand, you know, it teaches you that money can't buy happiness, although it buys a lot of stuff that apparently make people happy. But the, you know, there were other details that came out, like just a short time before the shooting took place last week, she had gone on vacation, and there was this picture of her, I guess, bobbing on a lake somewhere in apparently warm, with a drink in her hand, and yet that was put up against this, the statement she would make about how afraid she was to leave her son alone. So I don't know. Maybe she was only a Glenn Beck, Alex Jones prepper apocalypticist type on Days with R's in Them or something.
No, I see where you're going, and I totally agree. And I think you see my point, and I hope the other listeners do, is that, you know, normal people, if they were faced with this situation, if they had that kind of money, they would have used it in their time to really, you know, try to tackle this situation with their son. You know, they certainly had the money to get him the help he really needed, instead of becoming this, barricaded up, sometimes recluse, and, you know, these preppers, you know, that I'm hearing about now. And I guess what I'm trying to say is I really blame the parents, you know, because he, you know, the father had to have some knowledge. And to allow this situation to happen, since they had that kind of money, in my opinion, there's just no excuse. And, you know, that just really, really, you know, adds to this tragedy.
And I'm becoming more and more concerned, Carol, with the demonization of the mentally ill out of this, and the easy conclusions that are being reached. And I'm convinced that that tomorrow, when the NRA tells us what we may and may not do to deal with this crisis at their little press conference, conveniently held 1 week to the day after the slaughter, it'll probably be full of the crocodile tears for the mentally ill. But it will not be. There will be no solutions about the real, you know, root causes. It was interesting. I saw another thing today about a gun buyback somewhere in New Jersey, I think. And my God, there were Bushmasters, fully automatic machine guns, Uzis. And it seems like we've got to look at laws that speak to criminalizing the possession of a certain class of weapons, criminalizing possession of certain accessories for them.
Mm-hmm.
Pay people for the ones they have in their hands. You know, you pay people for what they've got in their hands, and then you criminalize the possession, and the penalty for possessing one of those damn things has got to be severe.
Well, what you're speaking of is, and you know, what's talked about on your program most of the time is moving to a more socialized, more common sense, more humane, more intelligent society. And essentially, if you set the gun part of it just aside for just a second, in my opinion, that's the root cause for all of this. Because even to make these changes, the changes you're talking about, which really are the only changes that would make any difference, there would have to be money available. There would have to be money spent. And of course, the lunatics on the right, they don't want to spend it on anything except making the rich richer. So obviously, any move towards those type of attitudes towards firearms have no chance unless we change our society in many ways.
Oh, and well, when I had that story yesterday, Carol, about Senator Rockefeller fulminating about video games and movies, yeah, I see the handwriting on the wall. I know where this isn't going to go, and where this isn't going to go is toward a real and meaningful solution. Once again, we're going to try to fix a sucking chest wound with a Band-Aid.
Well, exactly, and let me throw this out to you. Would you agree that in the past 20 years or approximately 15, 20 years in this country, that every time there is one of these shootings, it is right-wing crazies? It's not liberals or leftists or progressives who might own firearms. It's always right-wing nutcases that get their information.
At a rate of probably 99 to 1, yes, Carol.
Wouldn't you say? Well, so here we go again with so many of the root causes of our problem being the constant lies being put out by Fox News and all the radio media and all of that. You know, so here again we take these tragedies, and it has the same root causes as our health insurance problem and all the other problems. So, you know, and just to be honest, you know, I do own some firearms. I'm not a hunter. I've never been a hunter. In fact, I would describe myself as a dyed-in-the-wool, pain-in-the-ass animal lover. A couple of firearms I have were given to me by my grandfather. I was never in a hunting family. He just wanted me to learn how to shoot. It was never a big deal. And for decades, you know, that little .22 revolver and a bolt-action .22 rifle and a shotgun that we'd go out and shoot some skeet when I was a kid, just sat around and that was it, you know. And it wasn't until the last, I would say, 15, 20 years that the craziness even made me think of the firearms I really owned. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I do. And of course, you know, you're not necessarily in a rural setting. I am. And there's it's a different conversation. Now, I'll have the same conversation, be it rural or city, about Bushmasters and Uzis and, you know, things that can hold 100-round, you know, drums, banana clips, what have you. I'll have the same conversation with either person. But there is a different conversation to be had for people, you know, for people who live in rural settings where, you know, I mean, we've got coyotes here, and they can be aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And going inside and closing the door doesn't necessarily make them go away. They are varmints.
Mm-hmm.
And because they can carry rabies, yeah, I know I'm conjuring the scene from To Kill a Mockingbird, but that's a rural reality, and it's certainly a reality in the West. But things that have the capacity and understand that, you know, when we get down to 6-shot or 5-shot revolvers, even. We are still going to be making a deal with the devil that we will tolerate that much in our society, and we'll tolerate the mayhem and hell that comes from that in order to pacify the people who want them. But there's a line which we cross where I think we can no longer tolerate. We can no longer abide. We are no longer willing to sign off on that butcher's bill. And it's these semi-automatic military-style weapons. I mean, the Bushmaster shoots a .223 caliber round, roughly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
Now, that's a bullet not much bigger than a .22 caliber plink-plink rifle shell, right? But it is configured. It's a NATO round, is what it is.
Exactly.
And it is designed to do maximum human damage.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed, for instance, when it strikes its target, to tumble instead of simply going straight through.
Well, and it's a round that is less expensive than some of the other rounds. I mean, I'm not a military expert. I know some things about firearms, but what I'm getting at, what it boils down to is profit, money making.
Sure.
and really, that's where this all ends up again. And, you know, I'm kind of funny, you know, on the Second Amendment thing, because while as a leftist, I would prefer a world where we didn't want or need firearms. You know, the world is just getting crazier and crazier, and I certainly, for those of people who are in the middle ground to the left who might decide to own them, they are not the problem. Even though the firearms are the problem in some ways, it's this profit-driven, right-wing, corporate craziness that incorporates so much of all of our problems that is this problem, too. And that's just the way I see it. And don't get me wrong, I think that I would love to see sanity come to this country and our government and our representatives and incorporate the firearms problem with everything else and really start some progress. Unfortunately, you know, and this came up, you know, Sandra made such a good point about this yesterday, kind of to jump a little bit. Look at what our president is appearing to do already and start possibly making deals with the right on something he campaigned so strong against. The reason why all of us went out and voted for him again, that they would not touch Social Security, that we would make positive gains in areas like that. So, I don't know. You know, I'm very frustrated by all of this. And, I really don't have any answers at this point. But those are just some of the, you know, the feelings I have on this whole shooting incident. And I don't know. I guess once the new Congress convenes, we're going to see if they do make any progress on any of this.
And, I mean, are you as jaded as I am about that possibility?
Well, yeah, totally. Just when it just came out in the last couple of days that, well, you know, we're going to look at, the Social Security raises over the years for inflation and all, you know, that's the open door policy to this. And it's very frustrating to me. And you know, that's one of the reasons I listen to your show, is because I've got to hear some other sane people talk about these things. Because, you know, to remind people, I don't watch television, and I haven't for a long time. So, you know, my ear on the world is either reading books or listening to shows like yours. And I just don't know where this goes. But, I just wanted to make some comments on that.
Well, you know, there was some blather from Joe Biden today, and I that sounds disrespectful. I don't mean it to be as disrespectful as it sounds. But he was talking earnestly about, you know, we've done this before, and it was allowed to end. But, I mean, things like, and you know, you're in Vegas, right? I mean, there's gun shows out there, right?
Oh, every month or two. You know, I've never been to one of them, but they're out there. And you know what?
Well, I mean, and just from an Carol, just from an anthropological perspective, if you're not working and if you've got time, I suggest that you shell out the $5 or whatever at the front door and go walk through one of these things. It's like a trip to the zoo.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, you've got, and because you'll see these preppers there, and when they start talking, you know, if you stop and you know enough about firearms to talk with them about it, and they start, and they'll begin to wax poetic about these things. And I'm sure that every one of these gun shows, I would not be surprised to see posters of, you know, Barack Obama with a Hitler mustache.
Oh, well, no doubt about it. In fact, some of the guys I work with at the hotel, in fact, one that used to work there, an older guy, he's very much into these types of things. And you know what? You know where the main profit from those shows are? Is not selling of the guns. Ammunition.
Oh, sure.
Because
well, look, if you can buy rounds in their thousands without so much as showing an ID over the internet, how would that not be a monumental profit center?
Oh, you can walk in and buy ammo carriers, sealed ammo carriers. You can walk out with three of them, and that's 3,000 rounds of ammunition, and no one asks a single question.
No,
that happens all the time.
And you know, there's got to be. It would be nice if we would just simply disarm. It would be a great sign that we are a much saner community.
Yes, it would, and it would be nicer if we would get to single payer, so that people like you and I, even though I have health insurance, and by the way, just last week we had open enrollment, and they doubled the cost at the hotel of what I had to pay, and I went to an HMO because I wasn't going to pay the cost. But be that as it may, like I said, you know, it would be nice if we tackled all these problems.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be. But simple things like not being able to treat deadly firearms with the same way that we treat, you know, buying an old quilt at a flea market. That's a start.
Well, absolutely. I mean, they should shut down these shows right away. I mean, there's simple first steps you could take. You could ban new sales of assault weapons or clips. You know, we actually did it at one point, and then our good buddies at the Bush administration made sure that went away.
Right. I mean, that was a direct result of the power and influence of the National Rifle Association. But
well, you know, I'm kind of wondering if it's so much that, if it's not the power of just the Wall Street to me.
Well, I think that's there too, but it's also voter motivation because, you know, remember, and I know I've mentioned this before and you probably heard me say it, but it can't be said often enough. If in November of 2000, West Virginia had a history of always voting for the Democratic presidential candidate, all right?
Mm-hmm.
The Republican Party waged a hardcore campaign in this state in 2000 saying that Al Gore's going to get your guns.
Oh, absolutely.
They brought Charlton Heston here, and he absolutely set fire to southern West Virginia, and he did his "you can have my guns when you pry it from my cold dead fingers" shtick.
I remember that.
And on that alone, this state turned on its deep Democratic heritage. This state that is utterly reliant on Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, workers' compensation, labor laws, all of which came into being under Democratic administrations. West Virginia turned on all of that and gave its paltry 5 Electoral College votes to George W. Bush. If those 5 votes had gone as they had always been expected to go to the Democrats, the whole Florida fiasco would not have mattered, because Al Gore would have been elected president. And so, you know, I mean, there's a reason that the 3 G's have been said to be the mainstay of Republican fear electioneering: God, guns, and gays. By the time 2004 came around, it got so bad that at the Labor Day rally at Racine, West Virginia, put on every year by the United Mine Workers, they had to bring John Kerry in, and Cecil Roberts of the UMWA gave John Kerry a union-made shotgun. Okay? As some sort of totemic proof that he was okay with firearms. But they still said, John Kerry's going to get your guns. And then, lo and behold, another group sent around a flyer that went to only 2 states, Arkansas and West Virginia, showing a knife through a Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it has real-world political impacts in terms of motivating voters who might otherwise sit home because they think more of their godforsaken firearms than they do of any of the other liberties guaranteed in the Bill of Rights.
Well, and everything you're saying is just the same old thing, where you know, they were unsuccessful in this presidential election, finally, of just, you know, hiding real facts and hiding things that are really important by motivating enough crazy people who watch Fox News to, you know, move their way when they vote. But, you know, I have to go to work, so there's just a couple quick things I want to tell you.
Sure.
First of all, you know, I think I'm going to find out tomorrow night. I heard this week that, you know, my friend Sean is, there's the grand jury is convening, and they're going to convene tomorrow to get an indictment. So, you know, somewhere in the next couple of weeks, if I get on, I can let you know.
Do please.
That her husband is going to go to trial. And they've got a lot of evidence against him. I'd be really shocked if it didn't go forward. But quickly, you know, this Connecticut shooting again, what I thought about initially when I heard about this and really thought about it was, you know, those of us in this country that are old enough, we've gone through Vietnam and both Iraq wars. And sometimes when certain people get all up in arms about these types of shootings, you know, we've been killing kids for a long time in this country.
Absolutely.
You know, people. And I have to be a little harsh, I guess. When certain people who are on the other side of the aisle pretend to get all upset about these type of things, they had no problem when they saw their profit statement from their General Dynamics stock and their Bell Helicopter stock and their stock in all of Dick Cheney's company in this Iraq war that we're in now. And they never thought about the fact that we were slaughtering kids every day. And to me, that's something we need to really look at this country. And I'm absolutely not talking about the people who listen to this program, as you know.
I understand.
But I think that, you know, gosh, hopefully this last horror show might make a difference and might make us really as a country start looking at what we're doing, you know, whether it's here at home or abroad. And whatever needs to be done needs to be done. And on that note, you know, I'll let the other people get on, and when I have any news about the trial, I'll let you guys know.
I appreciate it, Carol. Thank you very much, and have a good night at work.
Okay, and don't worry about tomorrow. Nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, I think this coming from a guy who works the tables in Vegas, he knows the odds.
Well, that's true. So take it easy, man.
All right, see you, Carol. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Our buddy Carol calling from Las Vegas. Lines open 304-658-3333 if you want to jump in, assuming that everybody didn't just go away after the and what it was a problem with the 48K stream. Others were working. Let's do go to the phones though. Hey, welcome to the program.
What's up, Tiger Lily?
Hey, Jim, what's happening?
You.
I'm a trying.
I don't know. I was listening to your thing from the your broadcast there, and I was thinking of Bette Midler's thing about going down to Rio.
Yes.
I was flying down to Rio, and I could not even PO. It was fiesta, and I had to clap.
What a party.
That's it. So, it's supposed to happen Eastern Standard Time at 11:11.
Right. The only problem is that time has come and gone.
No, that's our time. So, I mean...
Why not 12:12?
I don't know. Why not 15:15? I don't know, Bob. I don't understand all this stuff and all this madness and stuff like that, but... your last caller made a lot of sense and stuff like that, but these gun shows... I mean, you can go to a firearms dealer or whatever, and there are things that you have to do, clearances. But then you can go to a gun show And the only thing you have to produce as far as identity is concerned is cash money.
Yeah, the only identification is the identification of Benjamin Franklin on the $100 bill.
That's it. And, you know, I don't think the Founding Fathers, when they wrote into the Constitution about, and I think it's part, what is it, Article 2 of the Bill of Rights?
Amendment 2, yes.
Was it Amendment 2? Or?
Yeah, it's the Second Amendment to the Bill of Rights.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think they envisioned the type of weaponry that we would have in our possession today.
No, they made a lot of presuppositions. Of course, the first problem we run across here, Jim, is the fact that you have just violated rule number one, and that is that only right-wing, hardcore, conservative Republicans can define what the framers' intent was. They've made that very clear. Because if we try to tell them what the framers' intent was, well, you know, that's just a bunch of damn liberals. But the Constitution is predicated upon a bunch of things that they were absolutely wrong about. You know, there was Thomas Jefferson who was writing after the Louisiana Purchase, which is, of course, subsequent to the ratification of the Constitution. But there's Thomas Jefferson who writes a letter talking about the Louisiana Purchase having added enough land to settle America, and these are his words, unto the thousandth generation. And they talked like that. There's other framers who talked about a thousand years of this and a thousand years of that.
Well,
and they were clearly just wrong.
Well, like I say, as bright as these people were, they could not envision the world of today. And, you know, the advance of technology, the advance of all types of things that could not be, you know, covered by what they wrote and what they saw at that time. I mean, what do they have in their hands? A musket?
Yeah, or look at a pistol from 1788.
Yeah, I have one in my house. Cap and ball.
Yeah, well, was it even cap or was it still flintlock at that time?
It's cap and ball. It's cap and ball, so it might be.
And so it's 1851 when, what was his name, Samuel Colt?
Right.
Comes up with the idea of the revolver.
And then, of course, you have Dr. Gatling and his gun.
Yeah, and in the intervening years, you have the Sharps repeating rifle that deeply offended Southern sensibilities. They referred to it as that damn Yankee rifle you can load on Sunday and shoot all week.
Yeah. Even, you know, as far as the Civil War is concerned, as far as artillery is concerned, I mean, the breech-loading cannon, what was that, the Whitfield rifle? Was that it?
I'm familiar with the Sharps and the...
Well, check out the Whitfield rifle. And it was one of the first breech-loading weapons that was used in the Civil War. I think the South brought several of them, or many of them, as many as they could, and so did the North, because the weapon could be fired much more efficiently and quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, before that, they had muzzle-loading cannons that had to be swabbed, and God only knows, I would hate to have been in the field artillery then. Because God only knows, when you put the powder in the thing, it can still have some residual and blow your ass right off the
back. Oh, the heat alone was, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's when, you know, I think the British were the ones who developed the Whitfield rifle. Maybe I'm wrong. Someone will correct me, I'm sure. But, I mean, weaponry has gotten to the point that it is very sophisticated, very efficient. And this has been going on since before 1914.
Well, you know, I've heard historians reference the fact, Jim, that in the era of Napoleonic warfare, which is roughly what we're talking about with the American Revolution,
as well as the Civil War.
Wait. There's a point here. In the era of the American Revolution and Napoleonic warfare, if you, as a soldier, were killed by a musket shot at greater than 100 yards, you were not only an unfortunate victim of war, you were also an incredibly unlucky person. Because remember, whether it be one of those very rudimentary looking pistols, or whether it be the musket of the Minuteman, we're talking about smooth bores.
Yeah, that's before when rifling came in, which enabled a projectile to maintain a steady course.
That's why, among other things, historically, the nation was so utterly shocked by places like the Hornet's Nest at Shiloh I'm thinking about Antietam, where the slaughter was so profound, because they were still using Napoleonic techniques of both sides march up across from each other,
right,
and let fire, and they were doing so with weapons that rendered Napoleonic warfare utterly mad, because all it did was get both sides slaughtered.
Well, the only thing I can say about Napoleonic warfare that was, you know, in its favor was march to the sound of the guns, and that's about it, because the guns, once you got there, were pretty horrific. And as far as marching men in squares, almost like a Roman testuda or testudo, it didn't quite work, did it?
Not so much.
23,000 people died at Antietam, one of the worst.
Right, and we're talking about people on both sides who had considerable military training. I mean, there was, you know, there was Lee, who had been at Chapultepec outside Mexico City, and most everybody else had, you know, Jefferson Davis himself. And yet, when they get to Antietam, they are shocked by their own carnage. Now, how can we begin understanding that to suppose, as the right wing is fond of doing, Jim, that the framers of the Constitution would have said that anything goes in, you know, I mean, my God, you've got Fat Tony Scalia out there who says that he would probably vote to uphold personal ownership of a rocket-propelled grenade launcher because it can be carried by hand.
A law, a light anti-tank weapon?
An RPG.
That's what it is, basically. RPG or a law, light anti-tank weapon. I used to teach guys how to use those things.
But Fat Tony Scalia says that since it can be personally carried, that it's okay to own it under the Second Amendment.
Well, obviously, that idiot never saw a law in operation or a light anti-tank weapon in operation. And it's basically just a tube made out of some high-form plastic, and basically you just put the round in and zero in and...
Well, you know, think of the German Panzerfaust.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was a very simple weapon that they used for...
Well, but one person can carry it, so
yeah.
Fat Tony says that, you know, that's part of the right to keep and bear arms shall not be abridged.
Now I want to ask you something. What in the world would somebody in civilian capacity have the use for a weapon like that?
You know, it's a hard question to answer, but I have known people in my life who have, for instance, owned grenade launchers. You know, it's a little bitty thing, okay? I mean, I'm sure you know what it is. You can't buy a real live, honest to God, fully functional military grenade, but you can make your own and fill them with black powder. And they're devastatingly effective.
Oh, Bob, these weapons are so devastatingly effective, you would not believe. I mean, from that to even the types of bullets that they use, for example, the old M16A1. I mean, that weapon was designed to fire a projectile upon entry into the human body, would not exit. But what it would do would be to shred the circulatory system of the area impacted.
Right.
And that's a dreadful
thing. And that's the same. That's the same operating principle behind the round that's fired by the Bushmaster. Because it's basically a civilianized version of what? The M4?
Yeah,
basically. which is the current issued personal, you know, the rifle, so to speak. I mean, gone are the days of the Springfield.
Oh yeah, yeah. I have one of those too. The ones that you have to flip up the back end and put the cartridge in.
Yeah.
And the cartridge is bigger than a cigar.
Jesus.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at one right now by the rifle. It was passed down through the family. An NCO rifle. And I can just only imagine. And I've had that shell in my possession, and I've seen it ever since I was born. And I asked my dad, I said, what in the world would be the impact of something like that? And he took a few minutes to answer, and he said, I can tell you what. Look at my leg.
Oh, Jesus.
And his was a bypass by a 50 caliber. I mean, these things, I mean, I don't know, these people enthuse about these weapons and how wonderful they are and whatever. And, you know, some of them are beautifully made by the Italians and people like that. But you've got to go further than just the nomenclature of the weapon and the impact.
Oh, right. I mean, let me, just by way of providing counterpoint, if you will, let me share with you, Jim, a story out of course, Florida. Tampa Bay Times had the story. Guy named, it happened in St. Petersburg. Two guys standing in line at Little Caesar's Pizza this past Sunday.
They got into it.
Well, Randall White, 49 years old, was standing in line waiting for his pizza and started getting cranky because his pizza was taking too long. Michael Jock, 52 years old, was standing behind Randall White and told, Jock to settle down. Jock told White to settle down. And you know, I hate to see people, and you see it all the time if you're out and about, people working miserable jobs and the people on the other side of the counter being just complete horses' asses.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it too.
So they get into, you know, Jock tells White to behave himself and to lighten up. White turns around and pushes Jock, and Jock pulls out his pistol and shoots White. Shoots him twice in the lower torso. And then when the cops get there, he says, yeah, well, I feared for my life. And the cops said, sure you did. And so he's out on bail now.
Out on bail. And shot a man over a pizza.
No, well, he shot a man over rudeness.
Well, basically, the rudeness was stemmed by his inability to wait for a pizza or his being castigated by...
Yeah, and I mean, in this case, I mean, I think we can say that the asshole is the one who got shot, but the guy who pulled out a gun over it proves himself an asshole by pulling a gun. It was a .38 caliber Taurus ultralight special revolver. He pulled it and shot dude twice. Now,
you know, Bob, we...
Yeah, welcome to America.
Yeah, we have expressed the horror over so many times that this has happened, have we not?
Yeah.
Columbine.
But I mean...
The school in West Virginia, or West Virginia Tech, was that it?
Virginia Tech, down in Blacksburg, yeah.
And now from Newtown, Connecticut. But the thing about it is, what is so terrible in my estimation is the fact that within 2 or 3 days, it'll be over. And people will become so inured.
Well, the funerals for the babies are going by at about 3 per day.
Oh, yeah, and your buddy over here got really upset about the fact that they were making so much ado about that.
Oh, careful how you throw around that your buddy business, Jim.
No, I was being facetious.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, that,
you know it.
You're very close to crossing a line.
That asshole.
Thank you.
That better? But I mean,
that Titanic wit?
Yeah, that Titanic wit who basically has a spirochete for a brain which could use a shot of penicillin. But, I mean, he was all a dither about that. And since his program has been cut to 1 hour a day, there were a bunch of callers who called in and said, this time I listened to it. Well, we're just real upset that you've been cut down from 3 hours to one, and we go do what we can about it after the first of the year.
What are they going to do? Draw down on cue ball?
God damn if I know, buddy. Damn if I know. I'll tell you, when I heard that, I said, I can't handle this. And normally, I basically will cut on the radio, which is right above the head of my bed, and you know, and it's next to my flag that I got. And I thought to myself, you asshole, what are you doing on the air talking about weapons and stuff like this, but you've never worn anything maybe except a Cub Scout uniform?
Probably got drummed out of them.
Exactly. And it's just ridiculous, the attitude of these people. And when you were going over with the caller from Las Vegas.
Carol, yeah.
Yeah, very good call. And it made a lot of sense. Absolutely. I agree with him 100%. But I just can't understand the mentality of these people. I mean, are they so stupidly wooden or so woodenly stupid?
Jim, I think it goes past and under that. I mean, we're talking about people who are so unutterably paranoid and who live in such day-to-day fear that it's a wonder that they can tie their shoes it's why you go for the Velcro, because you know you got with Velcro you can still have your pistol in one hand and do the Velcro with the other.
And yet these same people will vote against the very government that will try to help them as far as unemployment insurance, as far as Medicare, Medicaid, things of that nature.
Well, two out of the three members of the House of Representatives now in West Virginia are people who are gearing up to vote for so-called Plan B and screw this entire state. I mean, Jim, you probably know. I mean, what...
I've heard part of it.
What can you imagine the percentages are of people in this state who rely on SSI, Social Security Disability, Workers' Compensation, Permanent and Total Disability, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps? This state, there is no way this state could ever be self-sustaining.
No, absolutely not. It sucks on the tit of the federal government.
And so people who rely on that, I mean, it is statistically impossible that what I'm about to say is not true. People who rely on those things go to the polls and vote for people like David McKinley and Shelley Moore Cameltoe.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I never miss an opportunity to say Shelley Moore Cameltoe. Who are sitting in the House of Representatives, more or less figuratively, as we speak, chomping at the bits to F Social Security into the grave.
Oh, yeah. And if they have their way, what are they going to do, raise the cost of Medicare 30%? Is that part of it?
Well, I mean, that and the changed CPI business that some of these idiots are still talking about, where a Social Security retiree would have $80 less a month for food. And that's not just Republicans. You know, that's that bargain thing that has been talked about by the Obama administration. And
yeah,
as Sandra noted a couple of nights ago, lo and behold, the White House is shocked, I tell you, shocked, Jim, to find out that there's a bunch of Democrats in the Congress who say, oh, hell no.
You know, I can remember election night when we were so happy that Obama was elected as opposed to whom was running against him. And now, he is, you know, backing back and being pushed back and making all these deals. What was it, from 400,000 to or above 500,000 or whatever, to giving the 1%.
And meanwhile, the for-profit media are out there, you know, once a week or so, I devote a day to just watching the for-profit media and cringing the whole time. You know, CNN was desperately trying to get people to buy into the fiscal cliff, and they had this statistic that said 20 people think it's a crisis, 50% of people think it's a problem, 20% think it's whatever, and 4% of America think it's no crisis at all. And CNN was, you know, whoever was writing this drivel was saying, well, you know, America clearly needs to understand that these are desperate circumstances. Bullshit, Jim, bullshit. You know, Social Security is utterly sound within its present framework until 2037, at which point it would have to be tweaked to keep benefits at present levels. And as I'm sure that our good friend Benedict is presently typing furiously away in the chat room, Social Security is entirely a function of congressional will and not of any trust fund or any little bunker of gold in Parkersburg, West Virginia, or for that matter, Fort Knox. It is entirely a matter of what the people's representatives determine they want to do for the people themselves. And yet it's being bandied about inside these inane, insane discussions as if it was part of the problem. And the real problem that arises out of all of this, Jim, I think, is the fact that nobody inside the place you've referred to as the Forbidden City understands that the people who have already put their time in, who put their money in, who have carried this nation on their backs, are not in any wise responsible for the mess that the 1% made of this country through their insane, insatiable gambling on Wall Street.
You're right there.
Sorry, I didn't mean to sermonize, Jim.
That's okay. You have a right to, and I'm glad you did, because what you say is factually correct.
You know, how dare anyone from the White House to the Congress and points in between, how dare they suggest that an octogenarian great-grandmother has a responsibility to pay for Wall Street's mess?
Well, here's the point, Bob. They don't, none of this stuff that they're doing is going to impact personally on them.
Absolutely not. Social Security will never matter a whit to Barack Obama or John Boehner or Eric Cantor or any of that crap.
Mm-mm. No, as a matter of fact, no.
You know, Joe Biden was the poorest man in the Senate when he was elevated to the vice presidency. And he's never going to have to rely on Social Security.
No, because they have a very secure retirement package that will completely insulate them from the rest of the people.
And yeah, and the other thing that worries me about this horror out of Newtown is that under the cover, you know, while the nation is justifiably grieved and horror stricken, this will provide enough, oh, what would you call it, cover for, you know, Democrats and Republicans to come together on a solution, only for the sake of saying that they got a deal done, because that's all that the for-profit media and the punditocracy and the martini-sipping freaks want, you know, just a deal, any kind of a deal. Do a deal. Get the deal done.
Well, that's what happened in Munich in 1938, wasn't it?
Well, it sort of was, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. They all got together in that building in Munich. I've been there.
But, you know, cultures come to crossroads, Jim, and you are a student of history, as am I. It seems like every culture comes to a crossroad. We've spent a lot of time talking about, well, not so much here, but, and I had a little fun with it this evening, but whatever. You know, the Maya rose to tremendous prominence among their city-states over the course of, you know, 500, 600 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they rose and they fell. But ultimately, they completely depleted everything they had, and they had no way of dealing with that resource depletion, and the whole the megaculture collapsed. The people didn't go away. They're still there. They're still speaking the language that was being spoken 1,000 years ago. But that
the Mayans then had to exit their beautiful whitewashed cities because life in those metropolises or metropoli or whatever you want to call it, those cities could not be sustained.
Right, because what the it you know the calculations have been done by anthropologists as to how much labor, how much serf peasant labor has to be done in order to support a 1% class that lives in the city and, you know, mounts the pyramids and makes the pronouncements. And once it became unsustainable, they just it devolved, and the people wound up back in the jungles.
Exactly, eroding the base of their own society.
And the, and you know, you see that we see the same thing. I'm utterly fascinated with the fall of the Republic part of Rome. You know, over the course of about 100 years, Rome found itself as a republic in absolutely in knots, because it could not solve the problems of personal greed and personal lust for power. And so the Republican form of government actually collapsed under its own weight, because greed and lust for power came so far to the forefront that the structure itself could no longer hold, and that's how you wind up with Augustus. And then the trip from Augustus to Constantine is fascinating too, because even the idea of empire or of an emperor it could not be sustained. And eventually, by the time you get to Constantine winning at the Milvian Bridge, well, Rome is a backwater by then. Constantine's capitals were Nicomedia in Asia Minor and Trier in Germany.
Yeah, the home of Karl Marx.
Right. And so, you know, there's that. And there's, and of course, there's Rapa Nui and resource depletion. And cultures come to these crossroads, Jim, where they are presented with a problem that it seems they are almost incapable. I mean, because with history looking back, it's easy to point out what the fix would have been.
Well, it's true. Trouble is, nobody looks back at the fix, and they always want to repeat the same mistakes they made before, and it's just repetitive.
Or in the case of Rome, you know, the problem was soluble, save for the fact that people like Cato and Cicero and their useful idiot Pompey would not put their own egos aside for the betterment of the state. And the same thing applies in other words, personal ambition
and people jockeying for power.
And if we are not looking at that very self same thing, whether it be in regard to this culture's fascination with firearms or this culture's unwillingness to deal with the true existential crisis of our age for the entire planet, climate change. I mean, this is going to be assuming humanity survives climate change, this is going to be a no-brainer for historians.
Well, I understand.
They're going to look at the culture we live in today, Jim, and call us fools.
If they're around to look at us.
Yeah, or else, you know, the aliens from Norblap 12 are going to call us fools.
Or, you know, whether or not we blast ourselves into oblivion, who knows? But, look, I know you have other callers, but I apologize to Levy that I entered into this conversation with about flying down to Rio.
No, don't apologize. It was needed.
Well, you know, I just thought, well, that's just one of Bette Midler's things, and there was a reference to going down to Rio de Janeiro for the end of the world, that type thing. At least that's what I heard, because I had a lot of trouble tuning you in tonight. Just a lot. I don't know what's going on.
Well, the 48K stream had gone to hell, and it got fixed as soon as Ben Birch got home from work.
Really?
Yeah, that was it.
It's not your... do you think you're, like, supporting too many platforms for what you have?
No. What it is some of those other platforms rely on the lower quality bandwidth stream, whereas the 48K stream is much higher quality, and that's the one that most people go to, and that's the one that collapsed.
Oh, I see.
Well, but no, the number... The number of platforms is not relevant.
All right. That's good. And like I say, I had a difficult time in tuning in, and I haven't contributed very much tonight. But
no, it's been a wonderful conversation.
No, not really. Not really.
Oh, I'm sorry. You didn't enjoy it. I did.
No, no, no. I've had better ones, and I've had better things to offer. But, you know, considering what I have seen this week and what I have been seeing for a long, long time, it's getting to the point that I just don't have a whole lot to offer, because I'm so frustrated, and when I think of one particular situation or one particular solution, then I have to go through some type of labyrinth.
Yeah.
That not even Daedalus.
Yeah, that no amount of string and or breadcrumbs will get you back out of.
There you go, Theseus and the Minotaur and all that. Well, look, you've got other people who want to talk, and I'm not going to take up more of your time, but thanks. And I hope you have a happy holiday, and I hope that we don't have any catastrophic things happening over the next whatever. And
I feel confident, Jim, that we are the authors of our own catastrophes enough.
I think you're right there. Absolutely. We have written the book in which we are having to read, and it's not a very pleasant tale.
Yeah, and Evelyn Wood is of no help whatsoever.
No, absolutely not. Okay.
Jim, have a good night.
And to you too.
Bye now.
Bye.
Our good buddy Jim over across the river a ways. Go on to Skype here just in a minute. Lines are open, 304-658-3333. A couple of notes coming in from our buddy Michael. One, he says, NBC is reporting the Repiglicans have canceled the Plan B vote in the House. Next up, Plan 9 from outer space, paving the way for full-scale invasion. The orange ones are coming. And that's why they have their advance infiltrator, the boner one, waiting to do their dirty work. Earlier, Michael also pointed out, as far as the gods are concerned, and my suggestion that heart is probably leaping inside Dick Cheney's chest is probably leaping at the opportunity to be sacrificed. Under the subject line, the gods, Michael writes, "But Bob, you really think the gods would accept Dick Cheney as a sacrifice? They'd probably smite us all for the insult. Don't quit your day job, Bob. Leave human sacrifice to the experts." Point taken. Will from Chicago is with us via Skype. The handle, if you want to get involved after Will's call, is Bob Kincaid Horn. Hey, Will.
Hey, how are you? Good. Good to hear you. I just wish I was calling with better national news. I took a little time to reflect on the tragedy in Connecticut because, as you know, I have a master's in education, and I've been stuck subbing. I'm even now checking as far away as Massachusetts, where they will actually hire someone with a master's. And we are speaking as someone who has been in lots of classrooms with a variety of kids, including special needs kids. The suggestion that teachers should be armed in the classroom is absurd. I doubt that even SEAL Team 6, as well trained as any group of human beings on the planet, would want to have a firefight in a classroom full of special needs kids. And I've been in such classrooms under normal circumstances, and it can be a handful to begin with. So I think what we should do is seriously talk about what weapons make sense for hunting, some level of home defense, skeet shooting and the like, because the weapons we have today are so powerful that not even the minds of Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson could conceive of their raw power.
Oh, I think you're right, Will. When you're talking about having really high capacity firearms, you're talking about firearms that are there's no way that it takes 100 rounds to bring down an elk, a moose, a gazelle, a deer, an elephant.
Exactly.
A lion on the African savannah. To hunt with these things is considered unsporting by people who really care about the so-called sport.
Exactly. I mean, literally, we have weapons that people have in their homes that, were they somehow still alive, could probably take down a Tyrannosaurus Rex in a matter of seconds.
Probably so. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, we need to have a serious discussion, because I have been to schools where in the surrounding neighborhoods, 5 to 6 kids died per year because of gun violence from gangs. At one school I showed up at, there was actually a moment I was proud of, because students did a walkout, protested, and made the Chicago news. Why were they protesting? An honest student pushed another kid out of the way when someone decided to pull a gun on a Chicago bus. This was a few years ago, but I don't think we should be relying on our teachers to be responsible for security. That's not the way it's done in other countries. The Israelis, for example, if they need security, they generally have someone who is trained. A teacher is not a member of the special forces or the military or even a security guard. And also, a lot of other countries have restrictions on guns. Israel, Switzerland, Great Britain, France, and Germany have a much lower rate of firearms deaths than we do. Do people still kill people or shoot themselves or kill themselves? Yes, but generally not as much by shooting others or themselves. And I also think we have to talk about the issues of inequality, lack of access to health care, especially lack of access to mental health care. I have a second cousin in Winnipeg who's looking for work, and he doesn't want to come back to the U.S. because the health care is so much better up there. He might be forced to, but he's not going to be happy about it. But here in the U.S., we had a presidential candidate say that the solution to lack of health care was going to emergency room. Now, mind you, Mr. Romney did contradict what he said when he was implementing Romney Care, which was essentially a Heritage Institute idea, but we have politicians who so shamelessly flip-flop that they would probably put to shame a person making pancakes at IHOP in terms of flipping and flopping things. I think as Americans, we have to say enough is enough. We respect the rights of hunters. We respect those who want to practice shooting at clay pigeons. And we respect that, yes, if you are in the middle of Montana and your nearest neighbor is 10 miles away, you may have some concerns about your security. But we do not need an arsenal that if someone had showed up with it at any battle of the Civil War or the Revolutionary War, the other side would have run stark cry.
No, they would have died where they stood, Will.
They would have died where they stood, and the people at the back would have been gone stark raving mad at the sight of the slaughter. I mean, we have firepower now that a civilian can get, which would have boggled the minds of Napoleon. And yet we have people saying, well, we need our guns like that, pardon, to handle a tyrannical government. With all due respect to those who may have semi-automatic weapons, your semi-automatic weapons will do nothing against a drone with a Hellfire missile, an Abrams tank, a helicopter gunship.
It won't do anything against two cops who pull up in your driveway.
Exactly. And yet we have people who somehow think that they are going to be able to...
I mean, the notion, Will, that somebody with a Bushmaster or with a 20-round Glock or whatever is going to hold off the man is ridiculous. The idea and these are people who have families too, okay? So when that kind of thing happens, what they're guaranteeing is that their family is more likely to be harmed as well. Now, taking those two things together, what you find yourself having to confront, I think, is basically a Waco Ruby Ridge mindset.
Exactly. And I mean, literally, there are people who I think want Armageddon or the end of the world because this is the only way they can see themselves rising to the top. It's kind of insane, but there it is. Sorry.
And I think you're talking about realities here, Will.
But there
are deeper discussions to be had about the culture too, I think.
Yeah.
For instance, there is not enough wild. Every state in this union. Let me see if I can be kind of logically progressive about this. And by progressive, I don't mean liberal. I mean work from point A to point K, and get all the alphabet in the middle. Every state in this union has some sort of Department of Natural Resources. The purpose of the Department of Natural Resources, where wild game is concerned, is to maintain the population. And they maintain the population, I guess there's a certain amount of altruism in it, in that we like to have wild animals in our otherwise unwild world. But for the most part, these DNRs maintain animal populations for purposes of profit. Because people come to certain places or go to certain places in the country to hunt the wild game. There is not enough wild game in this country to feed this population. Okay?
No, so,
Ted Nugent, you know, I don't care how many the critters Ted Nugent kills with whatever kind of firearm or bow or, I don't know, throttles it with his bare hands. Everybody else can't eat like Ted, okay?
No.
Because this we are so far past that, and, you know, even little kids who go to their first hunter safety course in this state, and, you know, we start them early. One of the first things you learn about beyond firearm safety are ecological concepts of things like carrying capacity. And carrying capacity is the ability of any given hunk of ground to support X amount of life. And we are so far past the carrying capacity of this nation, this chunk of the continent, that in order for it to support the number of people that it does under some sort of kill what you eat mentality, the population would have to diminish by exponential factors. So let's understand that, and let's understand that I eat what I kill is a nice sentiment, but it is only that, a sentiment. Okay, we are past the ability of this land to support, you know, and I mean, I can walk outside and see a herd of 25 deer some nights in my yard. It's really frustrating because they eat my garden whenever I plant one. They're rats with antlers, as far as I'm concerned. But even with herds that size, they would be wiped out in a season if everybody here tried to live off of that. The same with squirrels. The same with waterfowl. I mean, we can't do it because we can't live in a way such that we would. So. Even if we're talking about respecting the rights of hunters, let's understand we are respecting the rights of people to engage in a leisure activity.
Exactly.
That's like saying we have to respect the rights of moviegoers. And, you know, how about respecting the rights of moviegoers not to be mown down with weapons when they're sitting trying to watch a movie that they paid $11 to get in and see? We're talking about
the rights of kids to be able to show up at that school, learn, have a little fun, spend time with friends, and go home safely. And not what we saw in Connecticut, and not what happens daily in the streets of our cities of someone not coming home because someone had access to a weapon that, in no logical way, shape, or form, they should have.
But we, yeah, and what I'm getting at is we have to deconstruct, and the mythology runs deeper than we think it does. We have to deconstruct all of this crap that has been imposed as some sort of thin, blood-soaked veneer on our country. You want to plink at paper targets? Fine. Well, can't you plink with a .22? That thing's plenty deadly as it is. Do you really have to plink with a godforsaken Bushmaster? Do you have to plink? I mean, can you not take your clip out and reload six more rounds into the clip and pop it in and keep plinking? I mean, can you not? Do you have? I mean, are we so God blessed lazy, Will, that we've got to have 100 rounds before we have to reload when we're shooting paper?
I hate to say it, there are some people who view that as a right, but then again, we have some Americans who, so help me, I think either view their weapons as extensions of their bodies or as a religious icon. And guess what? It isn't. Guns are designed to kill something. This is what separates them from cars or a knife. If you walk into any house in the U.S., chances are you'll find a knife. Generally, it's used to cut some sort of food. But guns are, when used as
designed, you can chop an onion with a knife, or you can use it to stab somebody. But it multitasks. On the other hand, right, I would not advise anybody to shoot a freaking onion.
No. I will have to say that one thing we have to look at hard with all the violence in our culture is ourselves. Why we are violent, what we can do to change. Yes, I know I heard a quote recently attributed to Yitzhak Rabin that human history is written in blood and we are desperately in need of changing to another color.
Yeah.
And obviously our own history is very bloody.
And note the fact that Yitzhak Rabin got killed for saying that.
Exactly. I mean, this is why, although I am a person of faith, I fear zealots and fanatics, because the historical zealots some 2,000 years ago were the ones who killed anyone who disagreed with them, expected a miracle, did it happen, and ended up getting a lot of people killed, the Second Temple burned, and the Romans were so abusive to the women that this is why in the Jewish tradition children born of a Jewish woman are automatically considered part of the community, because there was that much use of rape as a weapon of war by the Romans. And this is why I hate zealots and fanatics. I may not agree with everyone on every issue, but at least let's try to respect each other and be reasonable. Why I'm afraid we're going to hear from the NRA tomorrow when they give their press conference at, I think it's 6:30 Eastern on the Friday before Christmas,
that late in the day?
It is bloody late in the day. I'd have to double check, but I heard it was something like 6:30 or 5:30 or 4:30 Eastern, which is so late in the day as to be utterly insane. But I fear their remarks and their quote-unquote meaningful contribution will be to say, we cannot eliminate anyone's access to a firearm. And for that, I will say, God damn them to hell, because there are some people who should no more be allowed near any firearm than some people should be allowed near a thermonuclear warhead.
Oh, without a doubt. And, you know, this is something that has not been much discussed, and I would, and because you bring a very erudite conversation to the table, Will, do you know when the NRA was founded?
Oh, I forget when, but it has really changed from a...
Well, when it was founded has real meaning here. It was founded in 1871. Now, what was happening in 1871?
In the South, reconstruction by the Northern armies. And in the South, there were organizations such as the Ku Klux Klan that decided it would still fight the war, terrorize African Americans terrorized Northerners and tried to bring about Jim Crow, which they did successfully.
And so in protecting the right to keep and bear arms in 1871, who do you think that fledgling NRA was protecting? Do you think it was protecting? I mean, because we're also talking about the era of the beginnings of the so-called Indian Wars on the plains, right?
Right.
Or we're in the middle of the Indian Wars. So nobody out, none of those interloping settlers who are out there trying to steal land out from under the Sioux, the Apache, the Arikara, the Comanche, and so forth. Those folks don't have a firearm problem, do they? Because no one was trying to restrict their rights to them.
Right. In fact, in those areas, you would generally have a firearm, if not only because of dealing with the native populations.
And in light of the fact that there was governmental policy to try desperately to keep firearms out of the hands of the native populations, we don't want a fair fight after all.
Exactly.
The NRA was not formed to safeguard the firearms rights of the native population. Can we agree on that?
Oh, definitely.
So we've pretty much made clear that the places where firearms were much in play were not the concern of the fledgling NRA. That only leaves white folks in the north and the south. Okay, in the north, what do white folks have to need to defend against?
Very little. Your
Italian immigrants, Russian Jewish immigrants,
very little
Irish,
right, and also union organizers, since they were greatly feared.
So about the only thing you've got left is the Deep South and defending the rights of aggrieved whites to go on. Now, I don't know this because I haven't necessarily read it. I haven't read it. But just through the process of deductive reasoning, it stands to reason that if the National Rifle Association was founded in 1871, a time of considerable social turmoil in the wake of the Civil War and Reconstruction in the South, kind of stands to reason that the purest of motives may not have been in play, don't you think?
Oh, I'm sure that the motives were in. From doing a quick search, it was headquartered in New York, and General Ambrose Burnside was one of the founders, and they had rifle clubs, but it looks to me, based on that, these clubs were very, very
white.
Exclusive. Yes, or white, usually meaning white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, or close enough to fit in. And the irony is the NRA has gone from being mostly concerned about training programs to getting most of its money from the gun industry, the bullet industry.
Right, and consider also, Will, it's 1871. You've got a union, a former union general on the board or in the officer structure, and it's founded in New York City. And where was most of the firearms manufacturing taking place in this country at that time?
The North?
New England.
Yeah, exactly. New England, New York, and in general, the South. One of the great disadvantages the South faced in the Civil War is that the North had a better industrial base. But, I mean, now with our current NRA, even when there are polls showing over 50% of the members will support some form of gun control legislation. Why I'm afraid we'll hear tomorrow night is, at best, well, here is something that is so weak that if it was tea, it would not give a gnat a buzz, we're just going to hem and haw and delay until we get distracted by the new season of American Idol, and we'll move on to something else. But I think this time people are shocked, because this incident is every parent's worst fear, every teacher's worst fear, a community's worst fear. And the only way we can truly honor the dead is to improve the world for the living. This is the debt we owe to those who have died in the streets of our major cities, in our classrooms, in our shopping malls, in our movie theaters. We have to make sure that the world we leave behind for those who survived honors their memory. So if the NRA and the GOP want to block this and they want to fight, I am prepared to fight them from here to the gates of hell and beyond. This is enough. I am tired of dead children. I'm tired of people living in fear. I'm tired of people proposing solutions that are so insane that if anyone else in the rest of the universe is looking at this world and has hands, they are probably grasping their heads and shaking. This is a potentially brilliant species, but if they destroy themselves, I will not be surprised. We have the power to change things, and that's what a lot of people want us to forget. This is what the NRA wants us to forget. This is what Grover Norquist wants us to forget, and the Koch brothers wants us to forget. And the way that we can make a republic work is to be active. The way we can solve an ecological crisis is to look at it, find solutions, and take action. And inaction is a betrayal in this instance. We need to be bold.
I think you are absolutely right, Will. No two ways about it. And I hope you have a good evening and a good. Well, I'll be back tomorrow night. But thank you so much for what you've brought in. I really appreciate it.
Keep the faith. And by the way, quick announcement to the listeners. A donation to the horn in someone's name may be a very good holiday present. Let's keep this going, because this is what you will not hear throughout most of the country. Honest discussion on difficult issues.
Thank you very much, Will. That's very kindly said. And I mean, it's words like that. It's the challenges that other listeners offer to encourage folks to support this that keeps it going. It is all that keeps it going. I wish that we weren't constantly, you know, one bill away from disaster, but we are. And you know, an endorsement like that coming from someone like you means a heck of a lot.
Well, my hope for you in the coming year is the finances will be better. Someone will provide the money so you can have windmills going, so that no mountains were harmed by the broadcast, and that we will see the horn and like-minded programs begin to draw attention, because I think people are tired of the mass-produced loudmouths such as Limbaugh, whose main contribution to this planet will probably be by decaying back into it.
Hear, hear. Thank you, Will, and have a good evening. Bye now. Will in Chicago with a wonderful conversation. Just a wonderful conversation. Let's keep it rolling. Let's go back to the landline phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
This is Edward in Dallas.
Hey, Edward, how are you?
I'm doing real good. I had heard that Boehner had pulled his Plan B, and I told my partner, I said, well, now maybe he's going to Plan 9 from outer space.
you and Michael think in similar terms.
Oh, I just loved it. And, you know, all this thing about all these high-powered rifles and everything, I came from a family of hunters. Not me, but you know, and they killed deer and geese and ducks and things like that, but we ate them. They didn't kill people because we were not cannibals.
Right.
They just went hunting, and we ate what they killed. You did not shoot anything and kill it unless you were going to eat it.
But is there any doubt that the entirety of the United States could not support its population on a go hunting and kill it and eat it basis?
Not anymore.
The reason that, for instance, the West Virginia DNR repopulated the deer population in the state, because by about 1900, deer had been rendered near extinct here.
Well, see, they tried to do that with wild turkeys in eastern North Carolina. Unfortunately, some of these rednecks went out there and shot the turkeys. So they gave up on that. Oh, well. And, you know, I wonder if any of these people in the NRA have ever dealt with a muzzle loader. Do they know how to operate one?
Oh, sure. They muzzle loader season for deer, for instance. I mean, the selling of muzzle loaders is quite a business.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Bird. Well, you know, a cousin of
mine. And for muzzle loaders, they are very high tech now. They have, you know, have, of course, rifled barrels and percussion caps and the loads themselves are scientifically designed. And
well, I certainly didn't know that, because my cousin had a muzzle loader, and it was one of the real old ones, and it had the ramrod that was hooked underneath the barrel, and
yep.
You took that off, and then you put your powder in, and then you put your pea wad, and then you put your bullets. You tamped everything down and tried not to get a spark, because then you'd blow your wad, and none of those things are ugly terms.
No, they're not. No, they're not at all. In fact,
anyway.
I mean, I can say that the first firearm I ever fired was a replica Kentucky rifle that my brother-in-law had built, and he had built it from a kit, and it was a beautiful thing, and it was fascinating, absolutely fascinating, and it had a feeling of heritage to it. And you know, for instance, Jim talks about the collector's pieces that he has. You know, it is a matter of heritage.
Yes, it is. But you know, when you got all that done, all you did was go bang, and then you started all over again.
Right. And you know, the reload rate was you know, there were whole, entire military tactics that were built around it. I mean, I don't know if it's somewhere. I mean, because he had so many children and so many grandchildren. How I would love to have the muzzle loader that my ancestor, who was the first white guy to come in here and steal land, had. And you know, he had one. He was fairly prosperous, I guess, and pretty strong, brave, whatever. Because he had one, and he also had one for his wife when she. Family legend says that. When she was sitting there rocking on the front porch during good weather, you know, doing her darning or whatever, you know, there was a musket laying across her lap, too, because apparently the locals did not care for having their land stolen from them.
Well, yeah, we'll see. Something happened like that in North Carolina to my family. This was in the 1700s, and brothers started this shipbuilding factory, it was a business, and they were doing real well. And, of course, in those days, there were still Native Americans along the East Coast, and they lived in permanent villages, and they had the wigwams and all that, and they were hunters and gatherers and farmers and all that. And all of a sudden, one evening, and they were not warlike at all, they attacked this shipbuilding outfit, set it on fire, and burned it down. And someone asked me one time, one of my cousins, why I thought they did that. And I said, well, knowing the men in my family, they were probably fiddling around with some of the Indian princesses.
Oh,
and
no doubt.
Too. Yeah, it's probably true. Well, anyway, I'll let you go. And I was so glad to hear that Plan B failed. Oh, and I did want to say thank you to Thomas in Ohio for his codfish gravy recipe. It's exactly what I remembered.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if you can still get what the fish that you need to make that stuff, but I was intrigued when I read that. It was just, man, it looked yummy.
You can, because we went on the internet and you can order it through the internet.
Okay, so you're going to make a batch and report back?
I sure will.
Okay, well, let us know how it goes, and let me know if anything needs to be tinkered with. Send me the links, and by golly, we'll have some codfish gravy here. I don't know, over biscuits? Do you do it? Is it over biscuits?
Over biscuits or boiled potatoes, you know, anything like that you want to serve it over.
You know, it's just no fun if we don't get through an episode of this program with a little bit of food porn, Edward, and I thank you very kindly.
Well, I want to wish you, your family, and all the Horn family a very happy holiday.
And you as well, sir, and you as well. Have a good evening. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Edward calling from the general vicinity of Dallas. Michael writing in just a moment ago under the subject line, the phallic avatar. Ew. Michael says, I believe for many Americans, guns are a religious symbol. I call it the phallic avatar. And whenever you see a cold, dead hands bumper sticker, that's shorthand for, you can have my guns when you pry them from my cold, dead fingers. Whenever you see a cold, dead hands bumper sticker, Michael says, it is a declaration of jihad. Michael says, I mean this literally. It's pretty much time to get out of here. Before we do, I want to share with you a moment of remembrance. A dear friend of Appalachia and a dear friend of mine has passed away. This is what she sounded like.
It is impossible to overstate the harmful effects of mountaintop removal on the surrounding environment and communities. Not only are the waters buried under tons of rubble, the forested mountains become barren moonscapes. Mining complexes can be 10 or even 20 square miles in size. The communities below these massive operations are devastated. People are forced from their homes by blasting, by dust, noise, flying rocks, and the degradation of stream and well water. Life near mountaintop removal operations becomes so unbearable that generations-old communities are forced to move away.
Those are the words of an indefatigable advocate for clean water and a better Appalachia. Her name was Joan Mulhern. She was senior counsel at Earth Justice. You can read the memorial to her at earthjustice.org. We who struggle onward for human rights in Appalachia are made the lesser by the loss of such a dear, dear friend. Philip writing in at the toward the end of the program, this needs to be shared. He says, thank you so much for the conversations with Will and Carol. They are what make the show so fascinating and worthwhile to listen to. Also, a half-joking thought for a fundraiser. A day with Jim. I could think of nothing better than sitting on a front porch listening to Jim's stories and remembrances in rapt attention. Please implore him to consider making himself available to adoption as a favorite uncle or to desiring listeners. The best of holidays to you, Agnes and the Horn family. And here's to having actual expendable income next year to donate to the Horn on a regular basis. As for the president, he's a man who interprets our weariness with having to choose the better of two bad choices as a reflection of his popularity. In any other day and time, he would be a moderate Republican at best. We must work hard to have better choices. Despair just cannot be an option. Lastly, this country has been at war for almost every day of my 58 years. We have killed countless American Indian, Vietnamese, Iraqi, Afghan, and women and children of American Indians, among others, and justified them as necessary to protect the nation's well-being and prosperity. I weep when I see the photos of those killed at Newtown, but to express puzzlement at the violence in this country is to be oblivious of its history as a nation founded through violence, wars to possess land, enslavement of and violence against Africans and their descendants, and during our lifetime, wars for resources and to preserve empire. That from Philip. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, all of you, who make all of this happen. Robert's challenge from Australia, the Down Under challenge, was met. And thanks for that. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acact.org. which Joan Mulhern worked so hard to help produce. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.